Today, Reality Dawns, the Property Imperative Weekly to the 29th of February 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Last week, I ended my show with the comment the mirror was about to shatter. And this week, it did. The rapid worldwide spread of coronavirus and the economic implications of the outbreak have triggered the biggest weekly stock market rout since the 2008 financial crisis, wiping $6 trillion off global equities. With travel plans and conferences cancelled, airlines grounded, and even the Tokyo Olympic Games in doubt, economists are busily slashing their forecasts for company earnings and economic growth. And we will look at the carnage internationally first, but if you want to jump direct to the Australian section, the timecode is shown below. The world's economic growth in 2019 was barely above the recessionary threshold of 2.5%. The recent increases in cases in Japan and Italy, which are both large economies already on the brink of recession, will hamper global growth. Instead of the recovery, we could see even a bigger slowdown ahead. And it's worth pointing out that the virus has now crippled manufacturing in China, the world's second largest economy, and that should certainly have a ripple effect. And you can see my discussion with academic Salvatore Babones, China's upcoming recession. But it's not just the coronavirus outbreak that's pulling markets down. Lofty valuations and the 2020 US election have also raised concerns. And investors were extremely bullish for a couple of months, leading to the overvaluation of many stocks. So when conditions were ripe for a pullback, stocks tanked. And the United States, for most of this year, will face political uncertainty due to the upcoming election, eventually leading to gyrations in the stock market in any case. And bond markets are certainly screaming warnings of recession, with US and German 10-year bonds falling 20 basis points on the week, the latter hitting record lows of minus 0.609%. And even gold, that ultimate safe haven, fell as traders scrambled to meet margin calls triggered by the big stock market slide. And markets are looking to central banks to get them out of this mess. Cue the Fed. As today, in an unscheduled statement, the Federal Reserve said, "The fundamentals of the US economy remain strong. However, the coronavirus poses evolving risks to economic activity. The Federal Reserve is closely monitoring developments and their implications for the economic outlook. We will use our tools and act as appropriate to support the economy." The rapid pace of the coronavirus outbreak shows no signs of easing, with more than 82,000 cases reported worldwide following a jump in infections in South Korea and Italy this week. Nigeria and New Zealand also reported their first infections. And the World Health Organization on Friday raised its risk assessment of the COVID-19 to a very high global level from high in late January, but stopped short of declaring it a coming pandemic. But what's in the name? In mainland China, however, reported infections are slowing and authorities are ramping up efforts to open factories in a bid to alleviate supply chain disruptions. But as we discussed recently, the recession dynamic is in play and the true number of infections may be higher than reported. With so many countries, including the Western ones, struggling with the disease, the COVID-19 ceased to be an Asian issue and has become a truly global issue. So almost every single stock index in the world has spiraled lower, but developed markets have borne the brunt. A basket of nearly 7,000 stocks, including developed, emerging and frontier markets, have lost nearly $6 trillion, or more than 10% of their value since Monday. A 10% drop is deemed to bring a stock or index into correction territory, while a 20% slump is a bear market. But looking at individual stocks, almost 80% of South Korean shares and more than half of Japanese and emerging market shares and a third of the German index have entered bear territory. Wall Street's fear gauge, the VIX index, closed at a high of 40.11, up 2.43% on Friday, and these are levels last seen in 2011 at the height of the Eurozone debt crisis. And Wall Street capped off Friday with its biggest weekly loss since the financial crisis, but the Federal Reserve's pledge to support the economy in the wake of a growing coronavirus epidemic helped at the end of the day, with buyers coming into the market. And investor sentiment was also boosted by reports that the Trump administration is mulling economic responses to the coronavirus, including a targeted tax cut package. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 1.39% to 25,416. The S&P 500 slipped 0.83% to 2,954. And the Nasdaq Composite ended flat at 8,567. The S&P 500 fell for the seventh straight day on Friday, and the benchmark index suffered its biggest weekly drop since the 2008 global financial crisis. It took the S&P 500 only six trading sessions to slip into the correction territory on February the 27th, its fastest 10% decline from an all-time high. The rate at which the index declined over the past week surpassed the Black Monday plunge of October 1987. The Dow, in the meantime, lost nearly 12.26% over the week and closed in correction territory. In fact, the stock index suffered its biggest one-day point drop ever on Thursday. And the Nasdaq Composite joined the blue chips in the correction territory, down 10.54%. Banks led the sell-off, with JP Morgan sinking 6% as travel restrictions took hold and trading floors scrambled for contingency plans if offices were required to close. Goldman Sachs was down 12.94% over the week and down 1.8% on Friday to 277. The financial index closed at 509.70, and that's down 11.49% over the week, so again in correction territory. And in addition, US consumer spending slowed in January, according to the Commerce Department, which accounts for more than two-thirds of US economic activity. It increased 0.2% last month as unseasonably mild weather reduced demand for heating and undercut sales at clothing stores. Consumer spending had shot up 0.4% in December. And it could lose further momentum as the fast-spreading coronavirus outbreak causes households to tighten their purse strings. A separate report on Friday from the University of Michigan showed its consumer sentiment index increased to a near two-year high in February, but it noted that a fifth of respondents mentioned the coronavirus in the final days of the survey, in part because of the plunge in stock prices. The coronavirus epidemic prompted Goldman Sachs earlier this week to cut its first quarter gross domestic product estimate by 0.2 percentage point to 1.2%. The shrinking goods trade deficit could somewhat limit the downside to GDP growth. In a third report on Friday, the Commerce Department said the goods trade deficit contracted 4.6% to $65.5 billion in January, and goods imports tumbled 2.2% last month, and exports dropped 1%. Long-term interest rates have declined. The 10-year Treasury yield has plunged to 1.163%, pushing the long-term and short-term bond yields into negative territory again. The three-month was at 1.298, and so the inversion of the yield curve is there again and increases the odds of a recession. Winners of the week were high-grade government bonds that benefited from the safety bid and rate cut expectations. Markets are now pricing in a full 25 basis point US Federal Reserve cut as soon as March, more than two rate reductions by June, and more than three by September. The shift has altered the dollar's rise and its safe haven status. Long dormant currency volatility is also stirring. That's bad news for traders who have been shorting low yield currencies such as the euro and the Japanese yen, because any rise in volatility can quickly wipe out those trades. That can then send panicking investors scrambling to buy back those currencies. The US dollar index slid 0.42% to 98.10. The pound US dollar slid 0.48% to 1.28, and the US dollar yuan moved up 0.18% to 7.0045. Fears of a demand collapse caused by recessions are weighing heavily on commodities. Oil prices are headed for their steepest weekly fall in 4 years and have fallen nearly a third from 2020 highs. The WTI landed at 45.3, down 3.8% and down 15% over the week. Gold dropped 3.41% to 1,586, while silver fell 6.3% to 1,654. These falls appear to have surprised many, but first, many traders are having to liquidate positions to meet margin calls elsewhere, driven by large stock movements. Second, gold in particular is linked to its derivatives, many times the value of the underlying, and this creates significant exposures. And third, and frankly the least convincing, because corporates are yet to show real strains, there is no need to fly to quality. If disruptions in the global supply chain really exerts heavy pressure on corporates, then we could see the default rate ticking higher. In response, central banks will provide yet more support, and this could see the gold price higher or not. Be clear, gold is not the haven that some believe it is, nor, by the way, is silver. Bitcoin was down 0.97% to 8,683, and there is no evidence of Bitcoin's price having any sort of connection with the ongoing pandemic situation. Bitcoin advocates do not believe in central monetary policy, and they have their own reservations about the manipulation of the currency by central banks. It's not a safe haven either. In the UK, the FTSE has dropped from 7,434 at the beginning of the week to 6,580, down 3.2% and losing more than 12% in 1 week. British airline parent IAG lost nearly 10%, and the financials index was down 3.01% to 714.40, and that's down 11.26% over the week. Royal Bank of Scotland dropped 2.59% on Friday to 178.65 and has lost a quarter of its value so far this year. Amid all the coronavirus frenzy on the stock markets, the focus has somewhat shifted away from Brexit, which is still corroding the pound, particularly after the government published its mandate for UK trade negotiators on Thursday, in which it rejected a number of EU demands. The mandate means that the UK could still end up with a no-deal Brexit. Europe's main market slumped 3-5%, and the ongoing drive for safety sent yields on US government bonds, widely seen as the world's most secure asset, to fresh record lows. The European Central Bank is forecast to reduce its minus 0.5% rate by 10 basis points as soon as June. And they have nowhere to go, really. Europe's airlines and travel stocks have plunged 18% in their worst week since the 2001 9/11 attacks in the United States. In Asia, MSCI's regional index excluding Japan shed 2.6%. Japan's Nikkei slumped 3.7% on rising fears that the July to August Tokyo Olympics may be cancelled due to the coronavirus. The global rout knocked mainland Chinese shares, which have been relatively well supported this month as new coronavirus cases in the country fell and Beijing doled out more measures to shore up the economic growth. The Shanghai index was down 3.71% to 2,880 and down 5.24% over the week, while the Hang Seng index traded 2.4% lower after data showed Hong Kong's private home prices fell for the second straight month in January. Prices fell a revised 1.6% in December, and January prices were down 4.7% than the peak in May 2019. Japan's Nikkei 225 fell 3.8%, and while not a directional driver today, official data on Friday showed that the country's factory output rose 0.8% in January from the previous month, compared to an expected 0.2% gain, and a downwardly revised 1.2% rise in the previous month. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And so did the local market. The ASX 100 was down 9.67% over the week and 3.19% down on Friday to 5,345. The financials index was also down, and in fact it was down 9.08% across the week. The local volatility index was up 99.78% across the week and up 25.45% on Friday to 25.31. All the banks were hit hard, with ANZ down 2.74% on Friday to 24.83, CBA down 3.14% to 81.78, NAB down 3.05% to 25.10, and Westpac down 2.84% to 23.64. The Aussie US dollar was down 0.95% to 65.06, and that's the lowest for years, while the Euro Aussie was up 1.24% to 1.6947. The Aussie Gold Cross was down 2% to 2,436, and the Aussie Bitcoin Cross was down 0.97% to 13,269. Turning to home prices, the CoreLogic Index continued higher, with most centres lifting. Sydney was up 4.65% over the quarter, Melbourne 4.17%, and Perth only 21% lower. The trending chart showed a slight upward inflection now, having eased back a little, and prices, according to the index, are higher than their last peak in Melbourne and Adelaide. The remarkable divergence across the cities stand out, with Perth still significantly down. The total auctions listed last Saturday at 2,446 is higher than a year ago, where there were 2,293, and the clearance rates are higher at 72.7% compared with 49.4% last year. Sydney at 81.5% leads Melbourne and the other centres. Of course, volumes are still well down from their previous peaks, and the momentum may be impacted by the virus ahead. We'll see. Credit in January was up just a little. CR Post credit lifts a tad in January, but remains close to all-time lows. Owner-occupied housing rose 5.1% over the year. Investment housing lending was down 0.3% over the year, and personal credit was down 5% over the year. Business credit at 2.8% is still weak, as one in six businesses are now being hit by issues relating to the virus, according to a recent Roy Morgan poll. This week we also got the Senate report on the cash restrictions bill, and you can see my post, the cash ban report is out, who blinks first. We still need to keep the pressure on, as the report is a whitewash, with many of the key issues raised and the hearings not even addressed. And we're going to have more to say about this in the days ahead. Finally, ALP Senator Deb O'Neill questioned ASIC relating to the derivative risks in the banking sector, which is highly relevant given recent events.
I've got five quick questions just around derivatives. Are banks reporting on their derivative exposure effectively in their financial reports so that investors have a complete understanding of what banks are exposed to?
So banks are required to comply with financial reporting standards around financial instruments, which does include derivative transactions, but the devil is in the detail as to what those accounting standards require. And I fear I could spend the rest of the afternoon going through the precise detail of how it all works. So if there's a specific example, you might be able to provide.
Well, we might give you some time to give us an on-notice discussion paper about that.
Yeah. There's some recent changes on the accounting standards around financial instruments too. It's actually very quite
because I know that, you know, significant financial crises and major corporate failures over the past decades have actually involved these sorts of products, and we've discussed it, you know, in previous iterations of this committee. Do you think the financial positions and the risks of the major banks are sufficiently reflected in their audited annual reports?
Well, look, I'd be probably guided in that by what investors say in respect of audited reports. And one of the things that we included in a report that we issued at the end of last year around various measures of audit quality was an investor survey of what they think of the quality of audited reports.
Is this report 607?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my... I can Just let me have a look.
And I've got a question about that one in particular. In the 2019 report 607 on the audit firm inspection program, my question is, why did ASIC not report specifically on deficiencies in derivative reporting? Or did you do it in a different place? Is that what you're telling me?
It may well be because it's picked up under other categories. So, so it wasn't on the audit quality measures I'm talking about wasn't in ASIC report 607.
Yep.
There was a separate report that set out various potential audit quality indicators, and one of those did cover what investors think about audit quality, and there was nothing alarming in that result, but we can provide you with that report number. In relation to your question around why didn't we specifically report on derivative issues, I'll go away and check, but I suspect the answer to that question is it's actually picked up in broader categories. So two of the key areas where it's common for us to see problems in financial reports are revenue, but also impairment issues. And derivative transactions may be relevant to both those categories.
Right.
So it might just be a question of we've reported on the high level, but we haven't split it out into the individual things.
Okay, so if I can join two questions together.
Sure.
Did you investigate whether audit firms have adequate expertise and capability in examining derivatives as a significant product in the market? And should ASIC demand better reporting on derivatives, particularly on the notional values of exposure and counterparty risks?
Well, if I can go to the second question first, as I say, ASIC's role is not a role as a standard setter. So the explicit legislative framework that's been set up is that the Australian Accounting Standards Board sets the standards, and as I mentioned, for some time there's been a push for greater clarity around financial instruments, including derivatives, and there's recently been some significant changes to those standards. So those changes are in train. In fact, they may have even commence for some companies, but that's the second bit of the question. And apologies, I'm going to need you to repeat the first part of the question. Sorry.
So I think the issue here is that, as John indicated, the way we cut the results hasn't drawn out derivatives particularly as being an issue.
Yep.
And so we can, and it also hasn't been highlighted, certainly to me, as being a particular issue that we're concerned about, that there's a poor reporting, or certainly not saying poor auditing issues, but we can go back and review.
Yeah, so my question's around the competence, because really, if you look at it long-term, if we go to the failures of the past decade, we've got long-term capital management, 1998, Enron, 2001, Lehman Brothers, global financial crisis, Greek government debt, 2008. All of them were related to derivatives, so it's sitting there as a potential high-level incendiary risk from historical precedent.
So your question around capability,
I have to be the final question.
That's it. I'm done. Thank you.
I know with the introduction of the new accounting standards, which includes standards on leasing, amongst other things, financial instruments, there has been a concerted effort amongst the profession to train their staff to make sure that they will be able to apply these new standards as they're coming in. In fact, I've been on the public record saying the suite of new standards that have been introduced are the most significant changes in accounting standards since Australia adopted IFRS, the International Financial Reporting Standards, back in the early 2000s. So it is very significant. I have seen significant effort that's been employed by the profession to make sure that staff are adequately trained for these very important changes that are coming through.
Thank you.
She was able to expose that ASIC doesn't have any independent opinion or knowledge about derivatives, but simply hides behind the accounting standards, the details of which they cannot indicate, except that there have been changes. The reporting on derivatives in annual reports was reduced back in 2015. And the catch-22 is that the Accounting Standards Board probably says that it is dependent on what ASIC requires in response to investor and consumer demand. The general public would put derivatives in the too hard basket, and hence there is no demand. ASIC is just another box-ticking bureaucracy without real concern for the public, but have no doubt, derivatives will come home to bite us. So standing back, the coronavirus is the catalyst to a market correction that was always going to happen. Central banks will be trying to support the financial system by cutting rates and doing QE. But given that rates are already so low, chances are negative rates will become a feature for many, despite the fact that in Europe that strategy did not work. As I warned late last year, 2020 was going to be a crunch year, and so it is proving to be. And it's worth remembering that market corrections are part of the cycle, and central bank interventions have made the debt bubble bigger and postponed the inevitable, but the fundamental financial foundations are leaking at the seams. And the risks are rising. Against this backdrop, we expect home prices to begin to ease back despite all of the interventions. And it's worth remembering that locally, households have never been so exposed to so much debt, yet will be encouraged to take ever more to save the country. But debt on more debt is not the answer. And that's true, however the coronavirus plays out. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again.